Warning again, this will be our last lesson from me in Ephesians, for a while anyway. As you know, I didn't go completely in order. We did the beginning and the end toward the beginning. And so now we're going to end not quite at the end. but it's Ephesians 5:22 through 6:9, which is the very direct, practical section of the book. And so I've very much enjoyed it and gotten a lot out of it myself, so I hope you did too. As you know, Book of Ephesians, written by the Apostle Paul to the saints or Christians in Ephesus. And the theme overall that I feel has been through the book is of unity, especially in a church group. Chapter 4, 1 through 3 really kind of focuses in on that. Like I said, it's going to be the practical section, and you can see there's pretty clearly defined groups here, right? So first it's wives and husbands, and then children and fathers, and then servants and masters. It's a very logical kind of progression, and of course the groups there being one is a submissive kind of role, and the other is a leadership role, right? And so he goes to the submissive group first, and then the leader, and back and forth, right? So really, really simple, straightforward kind of idea that we'll go through here. You might say, what does this have to do with unity? Where does this fit into the book and all of that? And I would argue, it really has a lot to do. So if you think of the church as meeting in a building on Sundays, then maybe this doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But if you think of the church as the body, as in the people, not just on Sundays, but all the time, then it makes sense to have this sort of practical advice. And also, as we're about to get into, he connects it to the church in this very next section at the end of chapter 5 in a few different ways. Yes, I think it's very much connected. If you don't have these sort of attitudes of loving and caring for one another and submitting where you need to submit, so in a church you'd need to submit to elders, right? If you don't have those sorts of attitudes in the home, and in other places, then why on earth should you have those same attitudes in the church, right? In an assembly or something, or meetings or whatever. So, yes, it does relate. Maybe not as directly as you might think, but it's a mindset throughout all of this, right? And that's what Paul has been trying to get the Ephesians, I think, to see, is how to live as Christians, how to think like Christians, and how to be together. So we'll just get into it. First is the section on wives submitting to husbands. So I'll go ahead and read this. It's only three verses. Wives, submit to your own husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. So he's got a very simple layout. You in school you learn, right, your introduction and then your body paragraphs and then your conclusion. I think it's kind of funny that we call it a body paragraph, and he talks about the church as the head of the body in that body paragraph. So I thought that's a pretty good pun. Really straightforward, right? He makes it very simple in this first section. and so you say, well, where is all the content in this section? I feel like he should go on and on and on for a lot longer here, and he gives you hardly anything to go off of. Basically says the same thing twice at the beginning and end, and just that little bit in the middle. But I think the fact that he doesn't say a lot says a lot, right? The analogy is so straightforward that it doesn't really need explaining, I think is the idea. You know, should wives submit to their husbands? Yes, right? It's not a really complicated discussion. The world will make that a complicated thing, right? But he doesn't. he asks, or so you might think, you know, is marriage a partnership? That's a word you hear in the world, right? And so to that, I will say kind of. So this is kind of a funny thing. If you, I learned this only a few years ago. The word partner, comes from something. What is that? Anglo-Norman French. Anyway, it comes from another word, parsoner, which turned into partner in English. And the definition of parsoner is a joint heir. That's kind of neat. Because, when you think of joint heir, you may think of, Romans 8, 16 and 17. So if you have the chance, you might turn over there. Romans 8, 16 and 17. Your translation may say fellow heir. Mine will actually say joint heir here in King James. So Romans 8, starting verse 16, the Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. men and women are partners or joint heirs, just as men and women represent the relationship of the church to Christ, which is described as joint heirs. So it actually does fit. But the way the world means the word partnership may not line up with the biblical idea there, though. So be warned, okay? It may not exactly match that, but it is not the wrong word, to be fair. So, you know, does the church partner, with Christ in the way that the world might say? Well, we do, but we don't walk up to Jesus and say, well, now slow down in that commandment. You know, you and I are partners and I have a say in this. And, you know, I want my voice to be heard too. We don't say that to Jesus, right? We were the church and we do his commandments. And so, you know, we think of, I won't turn there, but, I gave this scripture, Ephesians 1, 17 through 23, but there's many more, that describe, you know, the authority of Christ and his dominion and, you know, I guess authority is the best word over the church. And so, you know, we know that it's a different kind of relationship, right? It's not a, completely equal plane kind of partnership, but there is a little bit of a difference in roles there, right? And so Christ is the head. He's the authority. He has all power. But you know, as we've talked about so much over the last few weeks, you know, the church has some latitude to fulfill the commands, you know, without knowing the exact specifics all the time, right? Just like in Proverbs 31, the godly wife, the virtuous wife, can fulfill, her role, with a lot of latitude in exactly how that is to be done. I think that's kind of simple enough. So we'll go ahead and move on to the next section, which is, on husbands. That is 25 through 33, and you may notice it is three times as long as the section on wives. So let's go ahead and read that. Husbands, love your wives. This is Ephesians 5, 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or any wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth it and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. You might logically expect this to be as straightforward as the last section, right? Just in reverse. So, wives submit to your husbands, and so you'd think this one would be husbands rule over your wives. And that is not what is said here. The command here is to love your wives, right? It's a different word. I don't want to get ahead of things, right? It's a different word, right? With of course a different message. and I think what we get out of this is not a strict legalistic or transactional kind of relationship. This is an emotional relationship. It is to love your wives. It really, I think you could summarize it as gut instinct. Even to the point where he says, you would take care of your own body, right? So why wouldn't you just instinctively, you know, take care of your wife? Just some of the words he uses in verse 25, husbands, love your wives, and that as Christ loved the church, he gave himself for it. So you would, you know, risk your life or somehow give up your life for your wife. Verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse it being the church. It's Christ with the church, but you were to take the analogy that that you would do this in your marriage, that you would sanctify and cleanse her. So such, you know, purity, right, in this relationship. The church is described as holy and without blemish, and not, of course, meaning physical beauty per se. I don't think in this way, but that, you know, you again, this purity, you introduce no spot in there. Like I said, verse 28, that you would love your wife as your own body. So that's, again, that's just that instinctive idea. You know, you don't have to be taught that, right? To nourish and cherish it. Again, you wouldn't let your own body, you know, die from hunger, right? You would feed it. And so in the same way, you would take care of your wife in the same way. Yes, feeding her food, of course, right? But more in a relationship sort of way, that you would always work on that, relationship. And then that sort of summarizing there, or transition, or I don't even know how to describe it. I would say it's a summary in verse 31. He quotes this famous passage from Genesis about Adam and Eve that Jesus quotes in Matthew 19, that the man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they'll become one flesh. That one's really, you know, kind of striking. I was thinking, you know, the kids would know this, I hope, but a lot of them would, right? If you mix red and blue paint together in a can, what do you get? You get purple, right? You don't get a can that has red on one side and blue on the other, and they refuse to mix. They are joined together. They are one color from that day forward, right? Nor can you separate them back out. That's I think the idea is the two become one flesh. Not like Frankenstein with stitches down the middle, right? But they are one singular person from then on. Yes. Okay. Another slide on the same verses here. So he's circling this around to the idea of the church, and Christ, or the body, right? There's that analogy that keeps coming through, that Christ is the head of the body, which he said in verse 23. So it's an obvious analogy that we see, but he's really kind of, you know, bring it all home, I think, in this marriage idea, you know. you know, he's saying, look at what Christ did for us and in his sacrifice, and all of that. You know, look at what marriage, is like, you know, this intimate relationship, this very sincere relationship. Look at your own self. You know what this is. You know what a body, what a head and a body do together. You know what this looks like. The body is fully obedient, but, in sincere love and devotion, because the head is so loving. You see this, you see example after example of this. And so what's kind of implied, I think, in all of this is when we look at the church, when we look at our place, in a church group, we should just know what to do, you know, submit when appropriate, to love each other always and to grow together. That's just what a body does, right? I mean, it's just how it is. and then, just kind of funny at the end of this section, he's like, but still, I meant the other things, you know, your relationship should be that the husband loves the wife and the wife, submits to her husband. So, he's like, I was making an analogy, but no, really, I did mean the other things. all right. So on to chapter 6. move my notes here. Children obeying the parents. And we'll read that. So three verses, chapter 6, verses 1-3. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. So a few things I pulled from this. This is different than submission. I didn't look at it myself, but the commentary I said, it says it's a different word. I'm pretty sure that's true. Obey versus submit. And of course it's a different relationship, right? You know, it's while children are young, it's do what I said because I said so. And hopefully you understand why in time, you know, you want children to understand why and to lovingly, understand, and appreciate how much you care for them. But at first, just do it. So that's, I think the command there is children obey. It is, obey your parents. He's going to, in verse 4, he says, fathers do this, but children don't obey just your fathers. Obey your parents. There are other scriptures, that, you know, explain that quite well, that, I think, I'm gonna turn there. I think this is the right verse, but Proverbs 6:20, that kind of show there's an authority that the mother has as well. Proverbs 6:20, my son, keep thy father's commandment and forsake not the law of thy mother. So yes, moms are in authority over children as well. And, excuse me. Like I say, I think this idea of obedience, you know, ends when a child is grown. Not that there shouldn't be respect, you know, when a child is grown to his or her parents, but, this idea of, you know, obey or else, you know, I don't think extends into the child's adulthood, right? You know, you see that in a few verses before that, right? In chapter 5, verse 31, that the man will leave his father and mother, so he'll be on his own authority, not still under his parents, right? the other tricky thing I saw in here is, in verse 1, obey your parents in the Lord. So I'll be honest, I kind of always glossed over that phrase. I never really gave it a lot of consideration until preparing for this lesson. What is meant there exactly? It sounds nice. I can't argue with it, but what is the meaning? What is the purpose of him saying, obey your parents in the Lord? one possible meaning, although I'll quickly shoot it down, but is that, you know, you obey your parents only if your parents are faithful believers. I think that's kind of nonsense, right? You just obey. There's no similar command given to husbands and wives, for example. You know, the teaching is that, even, you know, you stick with your husband even if he's not a believer in hopes that you might win him over without a word, right? Like, and servants, of course, have no such choice either, unless they just want to die. you know, and so I don't think children have a likewise choice to just up and leave the household at age 6 or something. So I don't think there's any strange permission there. one that might make sense is, you know, as the apostles had to refuse to obey their leaders at some times when they were asked to do things that were contrary to scripture. You know, you could see a child saying, I can't do that because that would just be wrong. You know, but be careful with that. You can't use that on everything. it's not wrong for them to tell you not to watch TV. Okay. You can't pick a fight over that one. Right. But extreme ones, right. And maybe just more, you know, if you look at Colossians 3:20, which is a similar passage, it's just, you know, just do this because God is asking you to obey your parents. So, don't want to spend too much time on that, but it just made me think, you know, what exactly is the meaning of that? I read some commentaries say that the phrase actually doesn't exist in some manuscripts, the "in the Lord" phrase. In this verse, but all the translations seem to have it, and one commentary said, like, there's really no good reason to say that this isn't part of the verse. So, I'd say it seems like it should be there. Okay. Honor your father and mother. That seems a little stronger, a little deeper, maybe is the word, than just obeying, right? There seems to be a love and appreciation, in that. You know, you actually respect and, want to do what your father and mother say, in that. And so, you know, that seems like that might be a command that goes in a little later into life, possibly, into adulthood as well. I would say maybe not necessarily, but ideally, that you would still respect and love and care for your father and mother, even when you're an adult. And also just keep in mind that, the word honor, often implies money. I just had another scripture pop in my mind. This is kind of a little more obvious, but anyway, Matthew 15, verses 4 through 8, is where Jesus is kind of scolding the people. I always just assume they're Pharisees, but I can't remember. Scribes and Pharisees. There we go. and he says, I really should have started in 3. Matthew 15, starting verse 3. But he answered and said unto them, why do ye also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? For God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, whoever shall say to his father and mother, it is a gift. So it seems like the context is money, right? Of some kind, or a gift of something of worth, right? By whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father and mother, or his mother, he shall be free. Thus you've made the commandment of God by none effect by your tradition. I'll stop there, but, you know, I mean, he's scolding them because they're saying they honor their father and mother, but they're not actually giving them any money, right? And so that seems to be the problem, in that situation. 1 Timothy 5:17 through 18 talks about elders, that you need to honor, elders, and that they're worthy of double honor, especially those that labor in teaching and preaching. And then his explanation is a laborer is worthy of his wages. So the idea is the honor is money, right? And then, of course, later in 1 Timothy 5, he talks about how, you know, you need to take care of widows, especially if they're in your family, right? So, you know, I think it's fine to think of honor as respect, but it also often means money. So just know that. And then, of course, this is one of the commandments, right? One of the Ten Commandments. Specifically, it's number 5, I'm pretty sure. The Bible doesn't number them, but I think I would call that number 5. It's Exodus 20, verse 12. excuse me. And it's pretty much exactly quoted the same. Honor thy father and mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And so that what he says in Ephesians 6:3 is still part of that command. That's the promise that you'll live long, which is kind of neat that it's as it says, the first commandment with a promise. I was reading over the Ten Commandments. So the second and third commandments, which is, you know, don't have idols and don't take the name of the Lord in vain, they have a consequence. You know, I will punish you, but it's kind of generic. You know, I will visit the iniquity on the third and fourth generation. You know, there will be a punishment, but it's not a specific thing. Whereas the honor your father and mother seems to be the, you know, a very specific, I promise this will happen. This very thing. Yeah, it's kind of neat. All right. Now on to fathers. This is the hardest one for me, as a father. It is a single verse. But I can find a lot to say, on this verse. So Ephesians 6 verse 4, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Again, just because it's one verse doesn't mean you get off the hook and doesn't mean this is easy. all right. So again, you might think the first one is children obey parents. So this should be fathers rule over your children. And that's not what is specifically said here. Make sure I advance the slide. Sorry. There's a love and kindness here, right? It's really to consider what's going on with your children, and reevaluate all the time, right? Is the way I take that. It's not just, simple ruling over. Does that mean fathers don't rule over their children? Oh, no. I did not say that. Yes, they do. Fathers must rule their households and keep children obedient, right? 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4. This is a qualification of an elder. and I don't think that means that everyone who's not an elder doesn't have to be a good, you know, ruler of their household, but just saying it to make it clear, this is something that's expected of elders. That 1 Timothy 3 verse 4, it says he's one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection, with all gravity. So, no, really. There is ruling that goes on there, but the focus of this verse in Ephesians 6 and verse 4 is not that. It is the care that's involved. our goal as fathers, it really should be trying to raise children to become good adults. There's times you just want to get through the day. Sure, I've been there, right? But the goal, the constant goal is to shape them, becoming, you know, adults, and ones that will love God, even through their childhood, of course, as well, right? But, that will love God, on through into adulthood, that obey Jesus, that are kind to others, maybe hopefully one day become parents themselves. This is what you're training for, right? And you just can't get there just by yelling. You can't teach them the love of Jesus by screaming at them. there are times for punishments and all of that, but, and you think of what Jesus said that the law and the prophets, you know, hang on the two commandments of love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself, right? It is love that is the foundation of the rules. And that needs to be an overwhelming part of the ruling. all right. So the specific things said here, don't provoke your children to wrath, right? It's hard. It's hard to not cross that line. Children are stubborn. They just are. Proverbs 22:15 says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. It is in there. That is not just, you know, a feeling, right? It is there. And discipline is good. Hebrews 12 talks about how discipline is right and useful. Discipline of a father, specifically, in that passage. it is good to discipline. And boys are especially tough, right? You want them to toughen up. You want to train them, to be tough. And so you often might train them with less mercy, because you want them to be stronger. You know, you can cross the line though, right? And go too far with that. Anger all the time is not right. And you'll find it's just not even effective after a point. as well. This is just not this is not the example that God gives, right? I mean, he has wrath. He does punish the nation of Israel. There are times. I mean, I'm not saying there's not times for all these things, but, you know, we also see a soft answer turns away wrath, and that blessed are the peacemakers, to turn the other cheek, right? We see so many other examples of the kindness and gentleness, that we should have. as for the nurture and admonition of the Lord, well, I mean, people have certainly made entire sermons of that. and so I really can't do much justice to it. In a short amount of time with all the other things to speak on here. But, the one I always go to is Deuteronomy 6 verses, 4 through 7. He says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and," this is the key part, "thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." and it goes on from there, but, you know, it's just a constant part of your life, right? It's not a one-time thing or a moment, but, it's just ongoing. And that's both daunting and a relief. It's not that you have to teach a class to your children, so they get it. It's something that will just always be a part of your conversation, right? All right. Next section, is about, servants obeying the masters. So we'll go ahead and read these four verses, Ephesians 6, 5 through 8. It says, "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as unto Christ, not with eye service, as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service, as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free." Okay, so I said this earlier, but, you know, you might think this is obvious, right? Servants, obey your masters. Well, no kidding. You might die if you don't. So why wouldn't you? Or you just suffer the consequences. So why does this need to be explained? Excuse me. Of course, the command is not just to do it, but to do it, as unto Christ. So it's a little ironic, I think, in that, you're doing it as if you're serving Christ. And who's a good example of that? Jesus, who himself served, you know, suffered unjustly, at times, right? Most of his life, really. So I thought that's kind of funny that we're doing it as if we're serving Christ, but he's actually the kind of the best example of suffering unjustly. I would argue it doesn't say that you have to love serving a master, in a sense, right? So, I mean, you can imagine the master could curse, commit all sorts of sins. He's human, right? He could put you in morally difficult situations. So, I mean, it's not that you have to love everything about this person in a sense of his actions, right? But you must do your job. And I mean, the job that God, has assigned to you, which is to obey the master. So that's, of course, very difficult. So again, just kind of looking over some of the phrases here. It says, to do this with fear and trembling. Well, no kidding, right? 'Cause he's going to beat you. but I think it means a little more than that. the phrase is a biblical phrase. I'll try to turn to these real quick. So 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3. Let's see. Okay. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3. Apostle Paul, in writing this letter, he says, "And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling." And in Philippians 2 and 12, on the other side of Ephesians, Philippians 2 and 12, he says, "Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." I think he's putting those words there not because you need to be reminded to be terrified of a master, but because it's a biblical phrase of fear and trembling the Lord, I think is what's implied there. and again, that goes along with the idea that you're really serving Christ, in this service to this earthly master. And I just threw, 1 Peter 3:2, which is that one we talked about of a wife, you know, that might possibly win over, her husband, in her service, you know, despite possibly very difficult circumstances. Maybe a little unlikely that you'd win over your master, but it could. That was the hope of Philemon. I'm drawing a blank. I think Philemon's the master, and Onesimus is the slave. Anyway, the point being, in that book, you know, it seems that the master might be learn a thing or two also. So, you know, the hard part, of course, insincerity, right? King James says, singleness, in verse 5. Yeah. And verse 6 talks about from the heart, right? So that's the really challenging thing, right? You could find so many excuses and every reason to not be happy, if the master was, cruel and sinful. All these things. So to do this, you could fake a smile, but that only lasts so long, right? You would break, after a while of faking the smile. The command there is to actually be kind, right? To really show that kindness. Jesus taught to, you know, if someone asks you to go a mile, to go one more, right? So we have that phrase in English, go the extra mile, right? And that's really what's asked here. I mean, I can imagine a servant being, you know, asked to, do something and then to do it and run away. And that's adequate, but, you know, you could also do the task and then say, "Do you need anything else, sir?" You know, I mean, you could actually like try to go that extra mile, right? and then, kind of wraps up by talking about doing good service. So you think of these examples in scripture of Matthew 6 and verse 1, where he tells you to, you know, give your alms in secret, not letting other people know about it. Matthew 10:42 of the turn there of giving cold water to someone in need. Let's look at that one, Matthew 10:42. I don't want to misquote that one. Matthew 10:42, he says, "And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water only in the name, a cup of cold water only in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward." And then Luke 6:35, where it talks about lending and expecting nothing in return. you know, those are those kind of actions that we can relate to. Maybe we can't relate to being a servant, in this context, but, there's so many ways that we can go above and beyond, right? Not just doing the bare minimum. And finally, single verse, chapter 6:9, the command of the masters. He says, so we'll go ahead and read that. Ephesians 6:9, "And ye masters, do the same things unto them, forbearing, threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is there respect of persons with him." So I'm going to start in the middle here, which, as I say, you know, often the main idea is kind of in the middle, right? And he's got the supporting ideas on the outsides. So the middle says, you know, knowing that your master also is in heaven. And so, I mean, the focus here is, you know, you've got a judge too, right? You know, you're a master over what, a plantation? Who knows? You know, lots of people, maybe lots of land. Could be anything, right? You know, and so you feel important. And he's like, your master's going to judge you. Don't forget that, you know, you're not, you know, everything, right? You have someone over you, and you'll be judged. And that's, again, this is one of those ones, it's a single verse, and yet what he doesn't say says so much, I think, right? You know, it's like, this is enough. You know, I'm thinking, you know, a master might even say a similar thing, to his own servants, right? You know, I'm going to judge you. Like, I'm going to go away. I've asked you to do something. I expect it done when I come back, right? Like, you know, I'm not going to sit here and micromanage. I've got other things to do. I expect you to just do this, right? Well, you as a Christian, as a master, possibly in this case, right? You're going to be judged in the same way. He's like, I'm coming back one day, you know? So you need to be ready, right? You know, and what do you expect of your own servants, right? You don't expect eye service only. So, you know, you should be the same way, right? And I think the idea of him giving this very small amount of instruction is you need to connect the dots, right? You're a manager. Don't tell me you're not smart enough to understand what I'm saying. Don't tell me you need more explanation. You're a manager. You're an owner of lots of property and things, right? I've said enough. You figure it out, right? You can't tell me, you know, like, we've all had people at work, right? You know, that say, well, no one ever told me, right? Well, the management doesn't get away with that, right? Not often, right? Someone who's just got a desk job, you know, can kind of coast on that for a little bit, you know, and not take any initiative to figure out what they need to do. But the management, they better figure out what to do. They better ask. They better know what they need to do. And so it's just what he doesn't say, I think, says so much, is that you should figure it out, right? I think I put it on the slide and not my notes here. It reminds me of the centurion, right? With Jesus. And then the opposite, right? This was a good thing that he did. The centurion, you know, comes to Jesus and says, you know, I think his servant needs to be healed, right? He's like, I don't even need you to come to the house. I have people under me. I tell them what to do and they go and do it. So Jesus, you can heal people. Why don't you just command it and it's going to happen? And Jesus says, you need to pay attention to this guy. He gets it, right? He's like, I have not found faith like this in Israel. Like, this guy, who's probably a Gentile, seems to get the idea, right? You know, you know how this works. And so it's almost, I think, the same way here, right? And he's like, your masters, you should know what's required of you, and you should be taking the initiative. There is no excuse here. You don't get to say, I wasn't told, right? I'm giving you one verse, and that's going to be enough. So, all right, so then going back through what he does say, he says, do the same things unto them. So, wait, what? Right? Like, the instructions to servants is the same as the instructions to masters. And again, it's kind of what we said, right? I mean, it's, you should know what it's like to be in that position. The centurion understood that, right? He understood, even though he was an authority, he knew that he needed the help of Jesus. And so, you know, these masters should get the same idea. It's what we call the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There's no real new teaching here, right? It's like, do the same thing unto them. Something I've always loved, since Bryant taught the class in Job a while back is Job 31, and I it's worth reading here, together. Let's see. Job, way back there. All right. Job 31, verses 13 to 15. Excuse me. All right. Job 31, 13 through 15, and this is Job speaking. He says, if I did despise the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they contended with me, so, you know, if I just ignored their need, right? What then shall I do when God riseth up, and when he visiteth, what shall I answer him? In other words, I have no excuse, right? If I'm mean to my servants, then I have no excuse when God, you know, comes looking for me. Verse 15, did not he that made me in the womb make him, meaning make the servant too, right? And did not one fashion us, meaning us both, in the womb? So he knows, you know, right, that there's this fundamental dignity of humankind, that the servants, even though they're your servants, are people just like you. They were made in the womb just like you were, and God will hold you accountable for not taking care of good care of them, and, you know, because you're the same. So Job understood that long before the New Testament was written. And so the same way that, you know, these masters have to understand that, right? There is no excuse. And just to hammer that home at the very end of this verse, neither is there respective persons with him. He's like, I don't care. You will have the same rule. You will treat people kindly, even if you are a master of servants. So, all right. So that's it. That's it for our lesson today and for our walk through, the book of Ephesians. So yeah, like I said, I've certainly gotten a lot out of it, over the last 5 weeks, I believe. Yeah, we'll close there and just, you know, just think on our relationship to Christ and our submission to him. And, of course, if there's any that are here, this morning that have not obeyed the call of the gospel, that do want to commit their lives, to Christ, to be part of the body, have counted the cost and know what the commitment is, to a lifelong, life of service with Jesus, then this would be an excellent time, of course, to come forward as we stand and sing.